that the National Assembly, quote, only needed everywhere to counter dictatorially the reactionary encroachments by obsolete government in order to win over public opinion, a power against which all bayonets and rifle butts would be ineffective. The first socialists were not political. Groups like the followers of Saint-Simon were trying to block themselves away from the rest of society and create a utopia as an example to everyone else. At the same time, you had, on the other hand, radical Democrats, many of whom remembered the French Revolution as a kind of lost glory or a lost opportunity. Marx was one of these radical Democrats. Some say that in the late 1840s he became a socialist, which they think means he stopped caring about individual rights, like the right to property. I would argue that his Communist Manifesto, he comes out strongly against bourgeois property, not private individual property. No one's coming from for your toothbrush. But they say that around the 1840s, Marx pivoted to talking about economic inequalities and started talking more about collective rights, such as the rights of factory workers to the wealth that they produced. We just got done talking about how capital read in an economic way is not very interesting. How you really ought to read Capital as radically humanist, as emphasizing the importance of fighting against fetishized relationships between people. That's its real power and genius. That means at the very end of his career, his philosophy was still Epicurean, meaning it was still a science at the service of human happiness. It was still an ethical humanism. So how did it happen that his followers end up abandoning radical democracy? I'm going to also argue that Lenin was a radical Democrat. I'm going to argue that Stalin was not. We'll get to that. What you don't get from studying the ideas of these great men is how a certain society made them possible. And that's what I really hope to get to. Let's go back to the history, okay? So after the French Revolution, France ended up with a restored monarchy. First, Louis XVIII was put on the throne by Napoleon, and then later, Louis Philippe. Louis Philippe had been one of the so-called progressive nobles and a part of the Jacobin Club. When the terror broke out in 1793, Elpizi fled France, living in Philadelphia for a while. When Napoleon took power in 1799, Louis Philippe returned to Europe, and having never plotted against the revolution, was able to go back to France in 1814 and reclaim some of his royal property. Bonaparte had passed a law that allowed the nobility to return and to regain some of their wealth, which is kind of a dumb way to run a revolution, but who asked me, right? Following a rebellion against oppressive state measures in 1830, Louis Philippe became the king, and he kept power by letting the bourgeoisie have a colonial adventure in Algeria. It's under the rule of Louis Philippe that Marx moves to Paris in 1843 to begin work at a radical newspaper. By that point, Marx's writings had become too radical for Prussian universities and for the Prussian press, which suffered a renewed repression. So if you're looking for a moment when Marx turns away from Enlightenment radicalism and democracy towards a socialism from above, this is probably that moment. I'm going to argue against that. But I know that Jonathan Israel thinks that that happened, and I have a lot of respect for him, and you should go and read Jonathan Israel. I think that in moving to a discussion of class, Marx was recognizing that free individuals must come from free social settings. You can't be said to enjoy liberty if you are starving to death. You can't really have a meaningful franchise if you're getting kicked out of your house all the time or if you have to work 16 hours a day. Your vote really doesn't mean all that much. And Marx must have really felt acutely the political isolation of the radical Enlightenment. And he seems to have been motivated to make Enlightenment ideals into a social reality. Something to move the masses. What could be more democratic? To the point. Ryazanov tells us that Marx balked at joining the League of the Just. Let me just explain. Ryazanov was the person who organized the Marx-Engels library in Moscow after the revolution in 1917, so he's no lightweight. After Marx moves to Paris, the League of the Just wants him to join, but he pauses for a minute. Quote Ryazanov, he did not join this league because its program was too greatly colored with an idealistic and conspiratory spirit which could not appeal to Marx. Marx objected to idealism because he associated it with small conspiracies, and he knew this to be an undemocratic dead end. Hal Draper was a Marxist commentator in the 60s, and in his Two Souls of Socialism, he gives us some details about this. Quote Draper, before they joined the group which became the Communist League, for which they were to write the Communist Manifesto, they stipulated that the organization be changed from an elite conspiracy of the old type into an open propaganda group that, quote, everything conducive to superstitious authoritarianism be struck out of the rules, that the leading committee be elected by the whole membership as against the tradition of, quote, decisions from above. In the socialist movement as it developed before Marx, nowhere did the line of the socialist idea intersect the line of democracy from below. Marx was the first socialist thinker and leader who came to socialism through the struggle for liberal democracy, unquote. So I'm not sure where Draper gets this quote from. He doesn't cite it in the pamphlet, not the copy that I have anyway, but it's very likely Marx did say such things. Since we can cite Engels clearly in his Confession of the Communist Faith. Now note, when I read this quote to you, how revolutionary action by the proletariat here is seen as the solution against the violence of the upper class in defense of oppression. As you wish to prepare for community of property by the enlightening and uniting of the proletariat, then you reject revolution? Answer. We are convinced not only of the uselessness, but even of the harmfulness of all conspiracies. We are also aware that revolutions are not made deliberately and arbitrarily, but that everywhere and at all times they are the necessary consequence of circumstances, which are not in any way whatever dependent either on the will or on the leadership of individual parties or of whole classes. But we also see that the development of the proletariat in almost all countries of the world is forcibly repressed by the possessing classes, and that thus a revolution is being forcibly worked for by the opponents of communism. If, in the end, the oppressed proletariat thus driven into a revolution, then we will defend the cause of the proletariat just as well by our deeds as now by our words. So during the revolution, Marx advocated armed uprisings to protect democratic gains against legally enshrined feudal privileges. The phrase he used for the resulting power arrangement was, quote, the dictatorship of democracy. After the March Revolution of 1848, a dual power existed in Prussia. This meant that there were democratic assemblies, a national assembly, and the two vied for power with the older government. We quote Soma Merrick. The establishment of a liberal cabinet had not come about because of the constitutional agitations, but because of the March Revolution, which breached feudal legality. The real reason for liberal objection to the establishment of democracy was not that it was to come through dictatorship, but rather that this dictatorship would give power to the exploited people. In a subsequent article, Marx wrote that the National Assembly, quote, only needed everywhere to counter dictatorially the reactionary encroachments by obsolete government in order to win over public opinion, a power against which all bayonets and rifle butts would be ineffective. The attitude of Marx, though not always the attitude of so-called Marxists, was always to adjust one's theory in the light of experience. And after the defeat of the revolution of 1848, Marx did just that. Remarkably, he never gave up on radical democracy. This is the period where he formulates his idea of permanent revolution, or the idea that the most vulnerable and oppressed could forge by democratic means a polity that would end class divisions. In the context of a Europe dominated by governments that allowed no meaningful political participation by the masses, the only realistic attitude for a democrat was revolutionary. Only by attacking material inequality could a democracy be established where some were not more capable or powerful than others. This is the fruition of a long meditation in Marx's life on the nature of democracy, a period that saw the writing of the Communist Manifesto, a period where Marx, so the legend has it, becomes a Marxist. Some American remarks. Quote, both the dominant strategy of proletarian independence and hegemony and the subordinate tactics involving occasional collaboration with the bourgeoisie were tried out in the revolution of 1848, and both were modified in the light of experience. What emerged was the final version of the strategy of permanent revolution, explained most elaborately in the address of the Central Authority of the Communist League of March 1850. Quote, while the democratic petty bourgeoisie wish to bring the revolution to a conclusion as quickly as possible, it is our interest and our task to make the revolution permanent, until all more or less possessing classes have been forced out of their position of dominance. The proletariat has conquered state power, and that at least the decisive productive forces are concentrated in the hands of the proletarians. For us, the issue cannot be the alteration of private property, but its annihilation. Not the smoothing over of class antagonisms, but the abolition of class. Unquote. Merritt goes on to explain what actions went along with Marx's permanent revolution line just prior to and just after his 1850 address cited above. In the lead up to the events of 1848, Marx had to oppose multiple conspiracies within the radical democratic movement to general insurrection. Note in this passage how Marx feels the need for an armed working class at the moment when a democratic government is being threatened by armed feudal reaction, and that in another context he argues against hasty action, preferring in Cologne to emphasize educational efforts, in each case the goal being to spread democratic governance and the Enlightenment philosophy of equal rights for all. Whenever the relation of force was clearly against the revolutionary people, Marx was opposed to insurrection. For instance, on September 25, 1848, when the authorities tried to provoke an insurrection, Marx prevailed on the Committee of Public Safety that they had helped to found to retreat in good order. This may be contrasted with the event of September 11th to 13th, when taking advantage of the popular discontent against the army, Marx and other communists, acting through the Democratic Association and the Workers' Society, demanded the mobilization of the Civic Guard and the direct election based on the universal suffrage of the Committee of Public Safety in order to fight counter-revolution. Gerhard Becker points out that this was the only revolutionary governmental organization in 1848 composed of the people themselves. As the name indicates, Marx's aim was to create a revolutionary democratic agency to carry out a thoroughgoing revolution. But the existing popular consciousness at the national level meant that in Cologne, an advanced outpost, he had to proceed slowly. In Cologne, they followed a policy of building a workers' society with its own paper, Freiheit und Arbeit, a democratic association, and the NRZ, the Neue Rheinische Zeitung. From the beginning, the latter functioned as a proletarian mouthpiece of the democratic bloc in attacking feudal monarchist counter-revolution. But from the very first issue, it also criticized the bourgeoisie for not being revolutionary. So, what actually happened in the event, the bourgeoisie, believing a broad franchise would mean the abolition of their privilege, drew back from revolution, leaving entrenched interests largely untouched. Germany would have a Kaiser for another 71 years. Revolutionaries had to decide whether to abandon the coalition between liberals and radicals. Navigating between capitulation to liberal monarchists and the abandonment of coalition politics, Marx and Engels plotted a middle path. The working class would be organized independently in coalition with liberal reformists until the working class movement was strong enough to assert itself politically. They utterly rejected conspiratorial politics then embodied by Blanqui, who was a figure whose idea of a small revolutionary clique dominating society became then and now a bogeyman warning the people away from left politics. This is the politics of Robespierre and of Stalin. And leftists who now embrace that way of thinking are playing to conservative narratives. And so we might as well ask the question here. The question will come up throughout the material. What do we think about liberal values? What do we think about human rights? It's all well and good to criticize governments who are based on liberal values for not living up to them. But then the question becomes, do we believe in those liberal values? Do we need to hold them up, or do we throw them away? I'm not going to offer you an answer, but I'm just going to pose the question here, and we'll come back to it. It's worth quoting Merrick at length, as she's one of the few people who have written about Marx's theory in light of what Marx did in practice, in his actual organizing work. Quote, after the failure of the revolution, when the Communist League regrouped in London, the balance sheet was drawn in the March address. It pointed out that in general, in the past revolution, the petty bourgeois democrats had hegemonized the working class. After insisting on the need for a proletarian party, it went on to explain that the Workers' Party should march together with the petty bourgeois democrats as long as the existing regime was not overthrown, but should organize separately the working class so that the petty bourgeois leaders could not consolidate the state with a few paltry reform measures. This process of unity and struggle with the petty bourgeois leaders had the aim of consolidating the proletariat and even winning over sections of petty bourgeois masses who at the beginning of the process followed the Democratic Party. The revolution was not to end with the conquest of state power by the proletariat. The immediate aftermath of the conquest of state power was seen as the concentration of the decisive productive forces in the hands of the working class. Throughout this period of permanent revolution, the task of the communists was to fight for the establishment and broadening of workers' democracy backed by the proletariat in arms. Unquote. Some of Merrick's revolutionary democracy, emancipation in classical Marxism, goes on in this way to provide a detailed accounting of Marx's lifelong insistence on democratic control as the goal of the progressive movement and as the means of achieving that goal. She very rightly holds up the failures and notable successes of the movement for women's rights within this broader democratic movement. It is perhaps textbook and cliché to note that once women were allowed into the workplace, it became harder to deny them equality based on gender. But seldom is the story told of how brave women like Clara Zetkin engaged in the workers' struggle and enabled a burgeoning feminist movement to get its feet. Soma Merrick tells that story. To buy and read the Soma Merrick. Her book is worth the effort 10 times over. I want to finish the discussion of Marx here and move on to why the socialist movement in Western Europe rejected democratic values. Naturally, many people identify Marx with the latter course of that movement, with an undemocratic socialism based on economism and class antagonism. One can sympathize if people misunderstood the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat, as maybe that meant something that was rather undemocratic. Late in their life, Marx and Engels had to face a socialist movement that became less and less united in a commitment to radical democracy. I go back and forth with myself wondering what Marx and Engels could have done, if anything, to counter this misunderstanding. Maybe they just assumed everyone was on the same page about democracy. I don't know. But I think Marx took radical democracy for granted, and Engels just wasn't aware that there was a problem or couldn't imagine a way to be relevant if he opposed the LaSallian tendency too overtly. I'm really not sure. If you have some insight into this, as always, please at me. I've already pointed out earlier that Capital should be read as an attack on the treatment of people as things, an affirmation of the need to treat all people, even the lowest in society, as having agency in their own lives. But what about Marx's final political engagements? Again, I can't in the space of this podcast do Marx's whole development justice. You'll have to read Merrick to get that. But let me just discuss briefly what Marx said about the Paris Commune. Marx and Engels both considered the Paris Commune of 1871 to be the first real-life example of what they meant by the dictatorship of the proletariat. In this 1872 edition of the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels wrote that because of the Paris Commune, the manifesto was in part outdated. And in the Russian version of the manifesto in 1884, Engels had the Civil War in France, their masterwork on the Commune, published in the same volume. So you get the idea. Marx and Engels were big-time stands for the French Commune of 1871. From his exile in London, Marx publicly and privately expressed his belief that the Paris uprising was a bad idea because he thought it would fail. And then he makes very specific criticisms about how once they announced the Commune, they should have marched on Versailles immediately. There are lots of good things to read there. Nevertheless, once the Commune was established, Marx gave it his support and rallied the English working class to it. It's often the case that a progressive and democratic movement gets out over its skis. The France of Napoleon III, which came after Louis Philippe and after the Revolution of 1848 and lasted until 1871, Napoleon III was like the Donald Trump of his time. And he had been suckered into starting a war with Prussia in 1870, okay, and this is kind of ridiculous, so bear with me, because nationalists in France had objected to Bismarck's attempts to put an Austrian Habsburg on the throne of Spain after Queen Isabella was dethroned in a revolution. Prussia had just gotten done mopping up the much larger army of Austria through the use of advanced technology. They had the train. They had the needle gun. So then the provisional government allowed the National Guard to be slaughtered by the Prussians by intentionally bad battlefield tactics. In this context, their seizure of power later is shown for what it was, an act of insubordinate self-defense. The first task of government is to protect the lives of its citizens, and when a government fails to do that or intentionally harms its citizens, it loses any legitimate title to being a sovereign state. This is not the last time we will make that observation. But into this vacuum of legitimacy, the proletariat stepped. And with this act, they became the first government in history based on the working class. So following the overthrow of the Bonapartist regime on September 4th, 1870, a provisional government was set up by Louis-Adolphe Thiers and others at Versailles. For their part, the socialists in Paris established a committee called the Republican Socialist Committee, emphasizing that what they wanted was to establish a public realm, a republic, a polity consisting in a publicly owned set of resources. Quote Merrick, this committee demanded, by a manifesto, the municipal elections, the control of the police by the municipalities, the elections and control of all the magistrates, absolute freedom of the press, public meeting and association, and so on. So we're clearly firmly in the garden of Epicurus here. The rural peasants of France still did not trust Parisian Republicans after the terrible mismanagement of the French Revolution. The resulting elections saw rural France sending to Paris some 400 monarchists, a reactionary majority. The left at that time had a mere 150 delegates, but among these delegates were the best revolutionaries of their time. Victor Hugo, Louis Blanc, Gambetta, Garibaldi, all the greats. The city was protected by the National Guard, which was an army of citizen soldiers. On March 18, 1871, the provisional government tried to seize the cannons of the National Guard, who promptly revolted. And that is the moment that Marx identifies as the beginning of the dictatorship of the proletariat. The Central Committee in Paris doesn't miss a beat and continues planning municipal elections. And in those elections, out of a total of 90 seats, the socialists and radicals got 60, and the liberals got 18. So these elections resulted in a body with a representation that was not majority working class, but which was majority radical. The composition of this body was nevertheless four times more working class than any parliament before it. According to Marx, the dictatorship of the proletariat was achieved once the National Guard seized Paris. Why? Because they were defending a democratic movement in Paris from a reactionary government that sought to suffocate it. Once again, the source of a state's sovereignty is civil society. At that moment, with the elections still to come, No state had been established, but civil society was poised to provide one. The commune had been rudely thrown into existence, largely by forces beyond it. The dictatorship of the proletariat thus formed depended for its existence on its ability to lead all the other classes of society, not in France, as it turned out, but in Paris. The results of the municipal elections were due to all layers of society rallying to the cause of the Parisian proletariat. Merrick remarks on how the middle classes of Paris were convinced to rally to a working-class government. Quote, "The past few months had shown that the French bourgeoisie, in pursuing a narrow class goal, was going against the national interest. In the first place, they refused to put up a resolute defense against the Prussians for fear of a radical revolution. Moreover, in accepting the German terms, including the payment of a massive indemnity, the Thiers government decided to float an internal loan. Newspaper reports claimed that the bankers who were prepared to back the loan also agreed to give Thiers and others 300 million francs as commission. On March 10, 1871, the National Assembly adopted a law on overdue bills, which set a seven-month moratorium for payments on security made from August 13th to November 12, 1870. No moratorium was allowed for payment on securities contracted after November 12th. This meant that workers, the petty bourgeoisie, small traders, and small industrialists were hit hard, while big capital was not. Finally, the National Assembly also refused to defer the payment of house rents any further. Such were the concrete events which pushed the lower middle classes towards the proletariat. But this proletariat hegemony was established partly by default of the upper classes, without adequate preparation on the part of the proletariat itself." Unquote. Now, after 1871, the socialist movement in Europe, having lost much of the generation who remembered 1848, and having had multiple disappointments with democracy, lost its connection to the tradition of radical democracy that originally informed Marx and Engels. In the next podcast, we'll talk about World War I, the Russian Revolution, the German Revolution. One of the really interesting figures from that German Revolution was Arthur Rosenberg. Rosenberg was a historian of ancient Rome until he was drafted into World War I. After Germany's defeat in 1918, Rosenberg joined first the Independent Social Democratic Party and then the Communist Party of Germany. He was part of the far left wing of the KPD in 1924, the part of the party that was still calling for a socialist seizure of power. Around 1925, he began to argue that the German Socialist Workers' Party had figured out a better strategy for representing workers' interests because revolution was then impossible. He left the KPD in 1927, disgusted at the domination of it by Moscow. When the Nazis took power, he fled Germany, finding teaching posts in Liverpool and then later Brooklyn. He died in 1943, but his books went through a period of renewed interest in the 60s. I can't help but think that Rosenberg's later historical writings must have been preoccupied with why his revolution failed. The answer, it seems to me, is for the same reason that the Black Panthers' revolution sputtered out. They did not compel a big enough part of society. Here is how Arthur Rosenberg understood the development of socialist politics after the failure of the Paris Commune. Quote Rosenberg, "The Berlin workers honored the memory of the March dead, the barricade fighters who had fallen on March 18, 1848, in the same manner as the Parisian proletarians kept alive the memory of the Commune. Nevertheless, the socialist workers of the German Empire had no vital connection with 1848, and consequently, the example of that revolution could teach them nothing concerning the present. In France, the radical workers were unable to forget that the June struggles of 1848, as well as the suppression of the Commune of 1871, had taken place with the approval of an assembly elected by the general suffrage. Napoleon III had employed general suffrage in order to bestow a semblance of popular approval on his shady empire. In 1867, Bismarck had introduced general suffrage for the Reichstag of the North German Confederation, and in 1871, for the new German Empire. From the point of view of the revolutionary labor movement, the results were extremely wretched. The German people continued to present Reich Chancellor Bismarck with the majorities which he desired. As far as any larger opposition parties existed in the German Reichstag, they represented the interest of the liberal capitalists or of the Catholic petty bourgeoisie. Now, general suffrage no longer appeared to be such a menace to the monarchies and the wealthy upper classes. Anyone who judges the historical facts of the 19th century objectively must undoubtedly come to the conclusion that the social significance of general suffrage was greatly exaggerated before 1848 and just as greatly underrated afterward. The temptation to consider general suffrage as something that would automatically work wonders was too great to be resisted. When the miracles failed to materialize, the entire arrangement fell into discredit. Actually, general suffrage cannot work wonders, but can only function within the limits permitted by the social structure existing in a country. If a completely ignorant group of people, unable to read or write, having no understanding of political concepts, and kept in a state of ideological and economic subjection, suddenly receives the franchise, it is incapable of deriving any advantage from it. General suffrage has just as little value in more developed countries if the government is in a position to falsify the election results at will, or to nullify the propaganda of the opposition by means of police suppression. France, under Napoleon III, furnishes the classic example of such employment of general suffrage. In 1882, Engels considered it unnecessary to demonstrate the historical bond which united his own socialist movement with the democratic past, since there was no longer any social classes anywhere, with the exception of Russia, which could have been moved by an appeal to the traditions of revolutionary democracy. And so it happened that, on the eve of World War I, the only socialist party in Europe that held firm to this radical democratic tradition were the Russians. An almanac tells us what the climate is, when to plant and when to reap. In this democratic socialist almanac, I'm going to review the history of the socialist tradition in the light of the latest scholarship. I'll be talking about the good, the bad, and every one of us living in between. Once we've sorted out how we got here, we'll survey the paths now open to us and begin a discussion of where we want to go. Follow us on Facebook, support us on Patreon, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from.